Everyone's in.
Alrighty, then we will go ahead and get started. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the City of Tucson Planning Commission. My name is Lexi Wellett, and I'm the chair of the commission. The responsibilities of this body are to advise the mayor and council and the Planning and Development Services Department on the adoption of long-range plans, policies, specific plans, and regulations that affect land use and development in the City of Tucson. Will staff please call the roll?
Sure. Okay. Chair Wellett?
Present.
Vice Chair Martin? Absent. Commissioner Zagier? Absent. Commissioner Cassidy?
Here. All
right. Commissioner Pafford?
Here.
Commissioner Young?
Here.
Commissioner Ortiz Epino, absent. Commissioner Schwartz?
Here.
Commissioner Warake? Absent. Commissioner Lane?
Present.
Commissioner McCancy?
Present.
And Commissioner Kinney?
Present.
And we have a quorum.
Very good. Thank you, Dan. Well, this moves us to the next item on the agenda, which is everybody's most favorite time, elections here. So first off, it's been a pleasure being the chair and serving with you all for the last year. Obviously, I cannot be the chair again, so I can happily nominate somebody if no one would like to recommend themselves, or if somebody would like to step up and take that role. Now is the time to discuss what the pleasure of the commission is here. Well, we can start backwards if that's helpful. We could start with the vice chair, since that is a space that I can fill. So I'm happy to nominate myself to be the vice chair. Moving forward into the next year. So if anybody else would like to step up for the chair, then we can perhaps do a vote there. Dan, I don't know what the procedure is exactly, but.
I believe there would be a nomination. And then if there's another nomination, more than one, I think there would be a vote, or I don't know. Pierre, you may have a better understanding of how that would work if there are two nominations. I haven't seen that happen. Generally, it's a voice vote for whoever gets nominated.
I'll second Lexi. This is Monica.
Yeah, I think we just need a nomination on the table and then.
Okay.
I nominate Lexi for vice chair.
I second the nomination.
Can we nominate Chuck Martin for chair since he's not here?
We could absolutely nominate anybody, and it just happened there. I mean, Chuck has been, I think, the chair several times throughout his tenure, if you will, with the commission. So maybe somebody else would like to. No takers here.
Second on the nomination for vice chair. So we should probably finish that vote.
Okay. So we have vice chair as me, and we have a couple nominations. I believe Commissioner Lane suggested the first motion there, and Commissioner Zagier seconded it. So I guess do we all those in favor of Commissioner Wellett being the vice chair coming into the 2023 term, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, perfect. Motion passes. I am the vice chair moving forward. So now let's go back to chair. So I was hearing some discussion about Commissioner Martin being the chair. Do we want to formally make a nomination there, or is somebody else willing to step up here?
I'll do it. I'll nominate myself.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner Cassidy. I will go ahead and second that nomination of getting Commissioner Cassidy as the chair for the next term. So all those in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Well, all right. Again, thank you all very much for allowing me to be the chair for the past year, but I now turn it over to Chair Cassidy to run the remainder of the meeting. So, Anna, the next agenda item is the approval of minutes and legal action report.
Okay. I need to open up the agenda. I wasn't prepared to chair the meeting here. My apologies. Okay, agenda item 3, approval of the minutes and the legal action report for November 16th. Is there a motion on the legal action report in the minutes?
I motion.
And I'll go ahead and second that motion.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? That passes unanimously. On to agenda item number 4, it's Plan Tucson. I'll hand the mic over to staff.
Excellent. Yes. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Corin.
Did you have some comments, Dan?
No, I was just going to introduce Jasmine, who is the project manager for Plan Tucson. She's going to provide an update to the commission for everyone.
Hello, commissioners. My name is Jasmine Chan. I am the project manager for the Plan Tucson update and will be put together a presentation for you. So we'll pull that up and take it from there. And you see my screen, or can you see the presentation rather? Okay. I'm going to see if I put this into full screen, if that continues. Do you still see my screen?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, hold on. I'm going to make my Zoom inset a little bit smaller. So this is an informational presentation to Planning Commission regarding where we're at with the Plan Tucson update. I am going to introduce myself and the other members of the core Plan Tucson update team, kind of talk about where the update is based in, what information is kind of laying the groundwork for what we are starting to put together, share with you all the timeline for the update, and then share about the community engagement program that was adopted by Mayor and Council in November, and then some next steps. So as I said earlier, my name is Jasmine Chan. I am the project manager for the Plan Tucson update. And I have two other team members on our core team here. That's Amanda Smith. She's a lead planner with PDSD. And Ian Wan, who's a planner also with PDSD. I believe Ian is in the meeting as well today. So the three of us are kind of your core members of Plan Tucson. There's plenty of other individuals who are helping us out and supporting the whole process within PDSD and also throughout all of the city of Tucson. So very grateful to all of the support that we've already been receiving, and that looking forward to also helping out with and supporting other projects as well. So the basis of the Plan Tucson update, I'm sure none of you are stranger to all of the work that has been ongoing by the city of Tucson, least of all Plan Tucson 2013. That's the general and sustainability plan that was adopted by voters 10 years ago, almost 10 years ago now. That process was initiated in 2011 and was voter ratified in November of 2013. The vision for Plan Tucson 2013 is working towards a thriving, sustainable Tucson through These goals and policies that are arranged by four different environments. So we've got social environment, which includes housing, parks and recreation, public safety, education, governance. Economic environment, that includes jobs and workforce development, as well as our regional and global positioning as an economy. Natural environment, which includes our water resources, energy and sustainability, and what are the, you know, other features that kind of come into play as we think about Tucson, where it's situated geographically. And the built environment, that includes land use, that includes transportation and urban design. So this document informs and is informed by development, zoning, neighborhood and area plans, and contemporary visioning and planning efforts across the city. This plan is the result of 64 public meetings, 5 public hearings with Planning Commission, 1 public hearing with Mayor and Council, and 1 special election. So Plan Tucson, the update, incorporates, looks to Plan Tucson 2013 for a lot of information around kind of where we were at, what we were thinking, and what needs to be pulled forward as we look to the next 10 years, and incorporates all of these other planning efforts that other departments have been doing as well. So that includes, you know, kind of department-wide planning efforts like Move Tucson from Department of Transportation and Mobility, and then the People, Communities, and Homes Investment Plan out of Housing and Community Development, and then more project-specific plans as well that have really far-reaching implications. So Tucson Norte Sur, the Equitable Transit-Oriented Development Project, as well as Reed Park Master Plan. This is just a snapshot of a few of the different plans that we're looking to for information around what our recent priorities kind of around these topical areas and what to bring forward into the general plan, what needs to be updated from 2013, what needs to stay, what needs to be changed. So that's kind of where we're seeing Plan Tucson update situated in. So the timeline for this update is fairly long, but may also feel like not long enough. So we've got a roadmap here. I've kind of split it into two, so the text could be a bit bigger for our screens here. But we're starting in, well, I guess we have 4 phases. I'll kind of get into the purpose of each of those phases a little bit later. But we're currently in phase 1. Where we're listening, we're understanding where our community's at, we're bringing forward all of these plans to maybe different audiences, maybe same audiences who haven't seen it or thought about it for a couple of years, to see kind of how that's resonating, learning whether or not that kind of makes sense for them. So that's the first 6 months of this year is this phase 1. Phase 2 is define and plan for the future. So that's where we're working on the initial policy development. We're looking at different scenarios for the growth map and where Tucson goes from here. That's a one year phase starting in this summer and going until summer of 2024. Phase 3 is review and refine. So that's the section that we're doing. We're bringing this the first draft of Plan Tucson to the community, to Planning Commission, to Mayor and Council for public hearings, for conversation, for more outreach. And that's summer 2024 to spring of 2025. And hoping for Mayor and Council to adopt Plan Tucson in the spring of 2025 so that we can be... have ample time for our phase 4 of informing and educating, particularly the voter base, about what is in Plan Tucson, what does it mean for individuals from the spring of 2025 until November 2025, which is the election that we are targeting. So our community engagement program is, as I shared, was adopted by Mayor and Council in November of 2022, and wanted to share with you all the guiding principles for the community engagement program. We have 5 guiding principles. You can look at, there's more explanation within the community engagement program that Dan has shared with you all. So if you want more detail about what each of these are referring to or what their motivation for each of these are, you can look there. But just as an overview, we have everyone is welcome, center equity, build up and collaborate, foster authentic participation, and prioritize safety and accessibility for our participants. I see a raised hand.
Hi, Jasmine. That's me, Monica. Just a quick clarification question. There was a public vote in 2022, and there will be a public vote in 2025. Is that correct?
In 2022, there was not a vote. So mayor and council did their vote. I guess that's not a voter, like a general voter type of process, but mayor and council adopted the community engagement program. And then 2025 is the year that we're targeting for the general plan to be adopted by our, I guess not adopted, but to be up for voter decision on that November ballot.
And then if it passes on the ballot, it would be adopted and implemented?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah, thank you for the question.
Can I add a comment, please?
Mm-hmm.
This is Jason McKenzie. I see there's a data analysis and previous plan outcomes in phase one.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that's to look at, you know, what were goals and objectives that were achieved and what weren't achieved and how, you know, we could do better next time around. I was just going to suggest that in the guiding principles might be something about, you know, that process and, you know, how we can do better, you know, in the next 10-year plan. In my career, I've always seen strategic plans are always, you know, heavy on the front end on forward looking thinking, but weak on the back end on backwards looking thinking as to, you know, what really happened, what were the good mm-hmm. outcomes, that kind of thing. So I would just suggest that as a guiding principle.
Yeah, I think that sounds like it would work very well in the document of Plan Tucson itself, within the community engagement program. On the last page of that document, we share kind of how we're going to be evaluating the community engagement side. So this like middle column of the roadmap that you see to ensure that we are kind of hitting the community engagement related guiding principles. But when it comes to like the guiding principles of Plan Tucson, the document, and then like the policies held within there and how that's then implemented, I think your point is very well taken for how do we do a better job of implementation or understanding where things are changing and why they're changing as we're kind of progressing along once the plan has been adopted.
I guess I see that, you know, community engagement would be strengthened when the community knows that, you know, these aspects of the previous plan were achieved and, you know, things got done. And mm-hmm. then, you know, these are how we're going to, you know, do better on the things that weren't achieved. I think that strengthens community engagement.
Mm, I see your point. Yeah. Thank you for that feedback. I'll take that back to the team to discuss kind of how that gets presented and incorporated.
You're welcome.
And so here's more detail about each of those phases that I was briefly outlining earlier on the roadmap page. So phase one, listen, discover, and reflect. Our key questions are, what are your visions of Tucson's future? How are recent plans and actions impacting you? And looking to get outcomes around community priorities and then also organization of recent plans into the update. So how is our community thinking about the different themes that are coming up across different conversations? How are they grouping those together? What then makes sense for how Plan Tucson update looks? Phase two, define and plan our future. right? So this is, what are major issues? What major issues may affect our community goals? How and where should the city grow and change? So this outcomes here are the preliminary draft of the update, and that draft that supports community's priorities. Phase three, review and refine. Do the goals and the policies that have been developed during phase two, are they in alignment with other recent plans, investments, city initiatives, where we're hearing from with other individuals as well? And the outcome of phase three would be update is approved by Planning Commission and Mayor and Council. And phase four is inform and educate. So what questions do people have about the plan? How will it be used if it's ratified? What does it mean for different individuals? And our outcomes here are awareness of the general purpose of a general plan and voter ratification of the update. I see that there is a chat. Oh, great. Thanks, Corin. Corin put into the chat a link to the Plan Tucson Progress Report. That was put together by Acacia, I think, in 2021. So a lot of really good information there, particularly as
I just tried to open that link and it didn't open. So
okay. Well, we'll get you a link that does work.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. And included in the community engagement program are a list of methods, engagement methods that we will be using. So we're seeing this kind of as a more of a menu of options. So we haven't prescribed yet which and how many of these methods are showing up within each phase. We're rather kind of taking a look at what are we hearing, who are we hearing from? Who are we not hearing from? How do we reach different audiences and what engagement methods might work for different spaces? So that includes our project website, different media outlets, developing a meeting toolkit for other individuals to be able to kind of work with their communities and kind of meet them where they're at, coordinating with interdepartmental team as well as intergovernmental teams, and then working group meetings. That was really critical in the Plan Tucson 2013 go round for doing that really detailed work and analysis as it related to policy development, understanding existing conditions, looking at different scenarios. So kind of looking at many different ways to be able to gain that input that we're seeking and we need for Plan Tucson update to be reflective of our community. So what's up next? We've got phase one, that's this January to June. We had our first event last Thursday. That was our open house, our kickoff. We had about 160 people come to that meeting. In fact, the picture here is from that event. Very excited for kind of the types of conversations that were happening during that meeting. We haven't fully looked at all of the input that we received during that, but very excited to see kind of what topics are kind of coming forward for folks. And then we're moving into doing community workshops. So that's more of a roundtable conversation format at different locations across the city, as well as a couple of online options, showing up for pop-up events, coordinating with community organizations that we're partnered with or different departments that are having events to be able to go and provide information about Plan Tucson. And then we will also start working groups later this spring, thinking that that's the earliest we will convene some of those. And on the kind of scenario planning side, looking at existing conditions analysis and then onboarding a scenario planning consultant. Abriza, I see your hand.
Oh, hi. So I was at this open house and it was, I like the format of this type of open house and having folks that you can interact with and ask questions of. There was one part that wasn't really represented very well. It was kind of hard to track down somebody to talk to, was some of the city park projects that are going on. There was no, it didn't show any of the plans that we the people had the opportunity to comment on as far as what they want the future of Randolph or Reed Park to be. That was the only thing there. Otherwise, it was quite well attended as far as having folks close to these posters to explain certain aspects that was on there.
Mm-hmm.
So is making sure that that there's people at the posters that can explain certain aspects of the different projects a little better would be appreciated.
Yes, for sure. Thank you for your feedback, Abreeza. And I have one last slide for you all. Invitation to plan with us. So as I mentioned, working groups will meet first. We'll first meet in late spring of 2023. We are working on what those topic areas look like. So that hasn't been made public yet. But would, if you're interested, would love it if you emailed us at plantucson@tucsonaz.gov, or you could indicate your interest by taking our survey that's currently live for phase one. There's a question in there for folks who are interested in joining a working group or getting more information about that. We do have a website. That's where the QR code leads to. That's the URL right below. There you'll find any upcoming events, also catch up on previous events. If you were not able to make it to the event last week, all of the posters that have, you know, the pictures and the content on there, all of those are available on the website in English and in Spanish for you to peruse to see kind of what we've been up to. And then link for the survey is there as well. And finally, we do have a newsletter. Please sign up. You can sign up through the website to receive updates on upcoming events and then staying up to date on the latest news about Plant Tucson. That is all I had from my presentation. So I'm going to stop. Well, actually, are there any questions that are related to presentation material so I can go back to any slides?
I was just going to suggest that you just send the Plant Tucson progress report to everybody on the council, but just for background purposes.
Yes, Commissioner McKenzie, we actually presented that to Mayor and Council last year around the time it was issued, and actually presented to the Planning Commission. I believe it might have been just before you joined the Planning Commission, but there was a presentation to Planning Commission last spring.
I'd just like to see the report. Thank you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It looks like Corin added into the chat the link to the TucsonAZ.gov Plant Tucson page. And there you can see there's a 2019 progress report and a 2022 progress report. And then, you know, the document itself is available in PDF format from that site. So Okay. Hopefully you're able to navigate that. And if not, send a note for sure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jasmine. And yeah. I just want to add a couple of things. So obviously we wanted to give this presentation to the Planning Commission now as we are starting the Plant Tucson outreach process, because Planning Commission is a very important part of this process. You probably saw towards the end in 2024, 2025, a box for public hearings. And the Planning Commission is actually one of the main reviewing bodies for a general plan. And the state statute actually specifies that the Planning Commission must hold at least two hearings on the general plan in different locations in the city. So that's something we'll be obviously preparing for at the end of this process. But our goal is to keep Planning Commission apprised of the planning effort throughout the next 3 years and make sure you guys are kind of steeped in what we're hearing and some of the goals and policies as they're forming over the next few years. Also on the note of those working groups, while we encourage all of you to be involved, if you have various interests, we're actually going to be inviting boards and commissions, including Planning Commission, to designate a liaison. And we'll be reaching out in the next month or two to ask that a member of the Planning Commission actually be part of a working group, the one focused on the built environment. That's where we're going to want to slot you guys in, so that you can be sort of a liaison between your board or commission, in this case, Planning Commission, and that working group. So more on that in the near future.
Abreeza, I see your hand again.
Yeah, so you mentioned that there's going to be two public hearings. Now, these public hearings, I imagine, fall towards the end of this process. So we're looking at, you're looking at, 2025?
We're hoping fall of 2024 for those public hearings. But again, we hope that is not the first you're hearing of what our draft plan is. So our goal is to provide an update to the Planning Commission, you know, every 5 or 6 months or so, as we're hitting some of the key project milestones, kind of update you on where we're at in terms of what we're hearing from the community, how that has started to shape the general plan, our goals and policies as we go along. And we also are going to ask that you appoint a liaison to the working group, and that liaison can also help bring information back to the Planning Commission. There will also be numerous, so there will be items periodically like this, informational items, where we're giving you an update. And as we get closer to that time for those public hearings, we will do some much more intensive, in-depth study sessions with Planning Commission. Mm-hmm. And it's a minimum of two public hearings for Planning Commission. There could be more. I think we'll kind of make that determination as we're closer. We may be asking you to do multiple public hearings around the city. So it is a big commitment for Planning Commission and a very big role that you all play in helping approve and make a recommendation to council about whether to approve this general plan and send it to voters for their approval.
Mm-hmm. And along with that, since it's going to, this is a long process. And so during this process, if any of us on the Planning Commission, we go through this stuff and we have a question. Now, do we contact that specific area, or do we go, is there a protocol? Do we send it to someone in PDSD and they forward the question on to the appropriate person in Parks and Rec, or how does this work? So, you know, we have a question about Reed Park and about the plan, that sort of thing.
If it's something that's sort of a subset of something that's going to be in the general plan, like the Reed Park, I would say the Reed Park project, that's one where you can continue to direct those types of questions to the parks project manager, whoever, you know, you might see at those meetings or events. But if it's really about the general plan itself, I would use that email address that Jasmine shared. And if they're not already up, we can share these slides with you guys. It's plantucson@tucsonaz.gov. Did I get that right, Jasmine?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Thank you. Yeah. So that's where you can direct questions just about the general plan, the process, you know, events that are coming up, things like that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions or comments for staff before we move along? Hearing none, we'll move along to agenda item number 5. It is a study session for case number C8-22-06, Planning and Development Services Code Update Package.
Okay, real quickly, I'm going to share my screen. Okay. All right. This is item number 5. It is a PDSD code update package. This is a study session for the Planning Commission to review the proposal and to ask any questions of staff related to this. I'm going to pass this over to Acacia to give you a little background on the process and kind of how we got to the current proposal that's in front of you.
All right. Hi, everyone. Good evening. Thanks for joining us. As you may know, this initiative was started at a mayor and council meeting back in June, directing staff to take a new approach in improving portions of the city's development code. And that actually includes a range of documents. The process so far has included research, outreach, public meetings, all of that to review what has become a package of proposed updates in the following themed areas, and that includes improving planning and development service department processes, removing barriers to small-scale infill, simplifying development standards, and addressing general errors and making corrections there where needed. So development of this package of proposed updates has included outreach, like I mentioned, to various stakeholder groups. That includes neighborhood representatives, people from development. We also got feedback from the staff perspective, both in our department and elsewhere. And we were also impressed to see a lot of engagement through an online survey where we had over 130 responses. We even extended that survey because there was such interest in it. The questions included, what suggestions do you have to improve City of Tucson development codes? Do you know what section of the code your suggestion applies to? And what benefits do you believe this will have? We have reviewed all the comments that came in. They are linked on our project webpage, so they're available for the public to see. I believe it's also included in your materials. So while there are lots of ideas, wide-ranging ones, through an iterative process, we've narrowed down to the package that we're going to present to you tonight. And we hope this is a productive first chance at this kind of package proposal, because we have record of all the comments and would like to consider them in the future, maybe in a similar kind of initiative. So as I mentioned, part of the survey included asking what kind of benefits do you think your suggestion will have? And the way that those benefit areas tallied up in this way, the majority was favoring transparency and clarity in development processes. Additionally, many respondents saw that these suggestions could have effects in more than one or multiple benefit areas. And that's a really great framework for what we're trying to do, like make a significant impact, but with thoughtful sort of incremental steps, incremental changes to the code. Just to touch on some other themes, people were interested in supporting a high quality built environment, reducing costs, especially for affordable housing, creating less time, less steps in the application process, and of course, improving our climate resiliency. And just a sample of some of the comments, just to give kind of a range of what people touched on. We'll have feedback on why some portions, some suggestions went ahead or weren't feasible at this time. But to note, there were requests ranging from simplifying lot line adjustments to considering how technology can be more incorporated into application requirements, making things more convenient, more streamlined, and people highlighting the existing barriers to a wider range of housing types in our city. And comments also included requests for more predictable setback requirements, lots of comments about parking and how those requirements have ripple effects on our land use patterns, and support for more incentives for affordable housing. So additionally, we held two public meetings earlier this month, one on January 10th and one on the 12th. We were able to hold one virtually and one in person. Just some stats on who attended, 90 total between the two meetings. We're able to watch our presentation and see these proposals like you're seeing tonight. We had discussions in the meetings and also provided online comment cards or paper comment cards. And feedback has been primarily positive. There have been some details to really dig into a little bit more. Some of the concerns that we'll point out that we heard through those meetings under the proposal, you'll hear about reducing parking requirements for small multifamily residential. People have raised concerns about how impacts to parking will play out in their neighborhoods, including worries that there'll be negative effects on walkability. There was supportive feedback to how this could support more varied housing types in the city, as well as reduce the heat island effect with less asphalt and make more efficient use of sites. So some other feedback that I'll touch on here, and I think this will make a little bit more sense when we get into the details of the proposals, but under allowing accessory structures in front yards for shade and for carports, some concerns were about the effect on contributing historic properties and a suggestion for the State Historic Preservation Office to do a courtesy review in those relevant neighborhoods. Regarding standardizing building setbacks on major streets, there was a suggestion for step backs to be a standard for taller buildings. So to zoom back out to the full package that we've developed since working on this, as I mentioned, there are a number of documents that these proposals fall into. So they're kind of color-coded for you here. We'll talk more about the differences between those documents in a second. Under that theme of improving planning and development service processes, in the United Development Code, a proposal is to allow administrative special exceptions for certain water well upgrades, remove the PDSD director decision process for wireless communication facilities that are co-located, and require zoning examiner legislative procedure for a major change of condition. Proposals that fall under the administrative manual are reduce development package requirements for projects that meet a certain smaller threshold, and require electric vehicle supply equipment inventory in parking calculations for project applications. And then an item that is in our technical manual is a proposal to align the timeframe for grading permits so that they match better with development package timelines. Excuse me. Sorry about that. Under the theme of removing barriers to small-scale infill, again, back to the UDC, a proposal is to remove setback requirements between townhome units, to reduce parking requirements for small multifamily residential, and to allow accessory structures in front yards to increase opportunities for shade, especially for carports. And then under the theme for simplifying development standards, again in the UDC, the proposal is to standardize building setbacks on major streets. So like I mentioned, and we've kind of already covered, the proposal package affects more than one document and each has its own amendment process. The Unified Development Code, the one that present company is maybe most familiar with, is the main one. The admin manual is a supplement to the UDC. It establishes more of the application requirements, procedures, and fees. Its amendment process does not require going to Planning Commission. It's actually can be initiated by not just mayor and council, but perhaps by the city manager or a director initiation. And the final decision is made by that director. And then the tech manual establishes just that, technical standards for access, for grading, utilities. Those amendments can be initiated by mayor and council, the city manager or a director. It does include a city development review committee recommendation in the outreach phase and is ultimately decided by the city manager. That's okay, yeah. And then just to zero in on what we're focusing on tonight, part of the required process, like I mentioned, for amending the UDC does require planning commission review and an eventual public hearing. So that's where we'll focus some of the details on tonight. And then again, just for a visual guide to what the focus is this evening, just the first three under improving PDSD processes, everything under the theme for removing barriers to small scale infill, and very much the simplifying development standards item. So with that, I will hand it back over to Dan, who will go into some of the details of these proposals.
Excellent. Thank you, Acacia. Appreciate it. And thank you, Commission, for being here tonight and going through and providing your feedback. So what you have in front of you is, again, as Acacia said, a package of seven amendments related to the Unified Development Code in those various different kind of categories. There we go. So what we have here, this proposal really seeks to look at improvement of those PDSD processes for some of them, remove barriers to small scale infill, simplify those development standards. And then at the very end, I'll go over a few kind of minor code errors. And these are things that in some cases, when we transitioned from our old land use code to the new Unified Development Code, something was omitted. It just was missed. It's a very large document, and we're still finding those every once in a while. Or it's something that was just a spelling error, or there was a wrong reference, essentially. So those are very small, non-substantive, but items that really help for clarity when people are trying to understand what requirements they may have for when they're going through the development process. So this is kind of how things were chosen. So as Acacia said, there were those 130 comments, 130 plus comments. Plus, we've had meetings, various public meetings and meetings throughout the last 6 months or so, internally, externally, and we came down with a proposal for 10 updates. And really, these are the things that kind of led us to that. We looked at the overall impact on the development process. What can really impact that? Results of reduction of staff resources to review or administer, so potentially becoming more efficient to allow for the kind of use of those resources elsewhere potentially. Minimal negative impacts on existing development and properties. So we were trying to find ones that had high gain, but little impact as far as negative impacts. So the idea is then maybe nothing is really truly low-hanging fruit, but those items that really do have that larger impact, but positive impact. And then legal feasibility of the proposal. This is back to that one that Acacia was talking about earlier about commercial lot line adjustments and the process that the county adheres to. And there have been several suggestions to match the county process. We did a bit of research related to this, and the state statute related to lot splits is different for the county than the city. So our process, it's not allowed by state law to go through and match those processes. And that's part of the reason why this wasn't included in this proposal. As Acacia had said, there were a lot of suggestions that are really larger policy decisions that generally would be done as a one-off process in this. So these are things like revisions to our flexible lot development ordinance, removing parking minimums. There were a lot of requests for removing parking minimums, removing all discretionary processes. And then there were a bunch of climate items like the rewriting of the commercial rainwater harvesting ordinance. It should be noted that the remaining suggestions will still be on an ongoing list. And our hope is that we would be coming back and doing this every 18 months or so with another package, and those would inform that those future packages. So this is the code proposal, as Acacia had said. These are seven items, and I'm going to go through each of them individually. If there were some concerns and feedback that was provided either, you know, through our public meetings or through comments, I'm going to try to address some of those through this and kind of provide a little bit of context to some of these proposals. So the first one we have here is the allow the administrative special exception for certain water well upgrades. So as it is right now, what's going on is that Tucson Water is looking to upgrade equipment on, I believe, all of their well sites throughout the city. And the well sites are existing. Sometimes they're in neighborhoods, sometimes they're not. But what they're looking to do is upgrade that equipment. In general, what ends up happening is that it's a very, very minor upgrade. So they're upgrading the equipment, but it still maintains a very similar footprint. They don't necessarily expand beyond the equipment area. Even in some cases, it actually has less of an impact where they're actually shrinking the size of some of the structures. So what we have in front of you here is an example of one of these water well upgrades. And if you look on my screen, the kind of light pink are existing features. And then this kind of dark pink is a new feature. So what's going on here basically is that everything's basically remaining the same. They're upgrading the equipment. And then this shade structure, which was previously 46 square feet and a height of 7.85 feet, is now becoming a new shade structure that is smaller. It's 40 square feet and it's the same height of 7.85 feet. So what we're proposing with this is to, instead of having this long zoning examiner special exception process, which requires a neighborhood meeting, requires a public hearing in front of the zoning examiner, what we're proposing here is to do another process that has notifications, so people in the surrounding areas will still understand and know that this is coming. They'll be able to provide input. But one that isn't quite as extensive because of the scope and scale of the changes that we're seeing related to this. What this ends up doing, and we're hoping benefits related to this, is that it supports, you know, public utility function. So Tucson Water needs to be able to upgrade their equipment and do so in a timely fashion instead of having to go through hundreds of special exceptions. And it would also allow for more efficient staff review. Again, you know, having staff to have to administer all of these special exceptions it requires a lot of time and effort. So this is the proposal would be to change that. We did have a suggestion at the public meeting that we had previously for a 400-foot notice instead of a 100-foot notice. Because of the minimal change that's occurring, we really do feel that the 100-foot notice is appropriate. It also already would notify the neighborhood association for which it's in. So it would be 100-foot notice, all property owners within 100 feet, and then also the neighborhood association. One other reason why we think it's a little, it would be challenging to put a 400-foot notice on it, is that it would be creating a whole nother new process that we don't have an existing process within our code that just does a 400-foot notice. We have a 400-foot notice procedure, but that requires a zoning examiner special exception process or zoning examiner review and public hearing. Commissioner Zagir, I see your hand is up.
Hi, yeah. So I was reading through this, and I just have a suggestion as far as the wording, because to add the word municipal water pumping, so that this doesn't let, because this also would apply to private wells or other private water companies that have wells within the city of Tucson, is that correct? You see where I'm going with this?
Yeah. No, I definitely see where you're going with this. I would have to look into this to see how it's being used. From what I've seen, it's all been Tucson Water and municipal water sites. But we can look into that and see if there's any negative impacts of using municipal versus not. But we're happy to look at that.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, so that's the first one. Second one that we have is related to wireless communication facilities and co-location of those. So this is to remove the PDSD director's decision process for wireless communication facilities that are co-located. So as it is right now, we have a PDSD director's decision special exception process for co-located wireless communication facilities. This is required in addition to standard zoning and building review processes. And what this does is that there are a number of kind of impacts of this. One is that we currently process about 40 or 50 of these. They do not require notification. And over since 2018, there have not been any site-specific conditions that have been added to those approvals. So it's really just it's looking at it, making sure that it meets the criteria within the zoning, and then signing that letter and allowing for them to go through the building process. That already occurs through the zoning process when it comes through and does this. One benefit of this, as well, is just the fact that what you're doing here is you're basically, hoping to reduce total number of cell towers by allowing for co-location of these antennas within the city. I mean, what we would really like is for them to use the existing ones instead of going through and putting in new ones. And if the process is just as challenging to put in a new one as it is to co-locate, a lot of times you'll end up with a new one. I do want to point out related to this is just the fact that this change does not apply to new towers. So it has to go on an existing tower. And it has nothing to do with those new 5G facilities or towers that you see in the right of way. As you're driving around, if you see like a light pole and then there's a 5G tower on top of it, it has nothing to do with those. This is existing towers. Generally, they're the larger ones that you'll see out kind of dispersed throughout the city. So that is the second proposal that would for removing that director's decision process for those. The third one in front of you is to require a zoning examiner legislative procedure for major change of condition. So this was directed by mayor and council at a December 7th study session. What it does is that this proposal would align the process for a major change of rezoning condition with other similar processes. So as it is right now, a planned area development, a mayor and council special exception, a zoning examiner special exception, all require this zoning examiner legislative procedure, which is a neighborhood meeting, a public hearing with the zoning examiner prior to it coming to mayor and council for a decision. As it is right now for rezonings, for some reason, it's a different process to where it's just a public hearing with mayor and council. Doesn't always happen this way, but in a lot of cases, that neighborhood meeting and zoning examiner public hearing allow for certain issues, especially issues with surrounding properties, to be worked out prior to it coming to mayor and council, instead of trying to hash it out at the table with mayor and council at that public hearing. So this isn't exactly streamlining, but we believe it's a more clear and probably better process to move forward with this. Just want to note that it is pretty limited in its applicability. There are generally about 1 to 3 cases annually that we've received when we've went back into the review in the last 5 years or so. Commissioner Wellett, I see you had your hand up, or actually Vice Chair Wellett.
Sorry, there's a little hang up there as to what my role is. but thanks, Dan. I appreciate the update here and what you guys are doing. I think all of the as a practitioner of the code, I think these are really great recommendations moving forward to help streamline some processes. However, on this one, I wonder, and I'm begging the question here, just, I recognize that, some change of condition processes or change of preliminary site plans can be more controversial and So I absolutely agree with going through this, allowing this process and making the zoning examiner hearing an additional avenue for public out or public input through the process. However, I wonder if there is a way that we can, because there are some cases that are very minor that you've suggested where it's, you know, often changing a preliminary development plan from a use that was more intense to a less intensive use, or a condition that speculated, you know, a center turn lane on a road, if you will, based on a use that was demonstrated and now the use is changing and that turn lane is no longer needed, but there's a condition for it, you know. And so I'm wondering if there's a way that we can consider looking at, you know, requiring this zoning examiner legislative process, but allowing for some relief for those minor cases. So one suggestion I have, you know, on your red lines here in the code perhaps could be where you suggest requires the zoning examiner legislative process. We add some language to the effect of this, that, you know, it requires the zoning examiner legislative process unless deemed unnecessary by the Planning and Development Services Director based on the outcome of the required neighborhood meeting. If unnecessary, the major amendment request requires mayor and council approval after a public hearing, similar to what the current requirements allow for, but just in the, you know, allowing those minor instances to continue to move through the process and not requiring additional resources, staff review, et cetera, for an otherwise seamless, you know, and minor request. So that's the only suggestion I have, you know, perhaps if there's a way to reevaluate, to allow for those more minor cases to not have to go through such an extensive process, but that be to the discretion of the PDSD director. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Wallet. So just related to that, there is a minor change of condition process that we also have with certain criteria. So we're happy to take a look at that and maybe come back to you and show kind of the difference between the two for that discussion. I think that would be a useful thing to discuss.
Thank you. Yeah, I do think that would be just the evaluation. And if we need to reevaluate, you know, some of the criteria, if you will, what establishes between a major and a minor, maybe this is that opportunity as well to look at that. So thank you.
Great. Thank you. Okay. All right, move on to the next one. All right. So this one is related to removing setbacks requirements for townhouse units. Basically what's going on right now is that required internal setbacks make it really challenging to build townhomes. You cannot do that currently you cannot currently do that by right because there is a required setback between units. What you have to do is it kind of pushes you through a more challenging process where you have to go through either a flexible lot development process or it has to be a conversion. So you would basically build as a condo and then convert to a townhome. So what we're looking at here is creating an actual by right for something that can be done as multifamily but cannot be done as a single family, single ownership unit. So as it is right now, we are proposing to, in zones that allow multifamily, R2 and higher, it would allow single family attached, dwellings. And then it would clarify that interior setbacks do not apply between units. So related to this, again, this helps with, a type of housing that we really don't see a lot in the city of Tucson. So try to promote missing middle housing and some of those units, especially the home ownership option, not just the rental option that we have in this housing type. It encourages small scale infill development, allows for more efficient use of space on site potentially. And it allows a type of housing that is already really allowed as a rental, as I've mentioned. We did get a comment from Commissioner, there were some comments that were submitted from Commissioner Martin related to this one. We have been meeting with building. He had a comment related to, I think in the FOB, when you do have the townhome, it's basically, you can set back whatever the building code allows. And if you have a firewall or you have, there's certain criteria you have to have for townhomes to make sure that there there is that fire separation. In our conversations with our chief building official, we don't believe it's necessary to clarify that in there, but you know, it's kind of up to the commission related to that. And then the other comment related to that was just the fact that we are adding this housing type. And there was a concern about the minimum lot size that are within those single family districts. So R2 and R3 have a 5,000 square foot minimum lot size. However, you can, you know, there's multifamily densities where you can actually build more dense development. One potential solution to that, it's still good to add this housing type, would be to potentially allow for whatever the equivalent of that, of the multifamily density and whatever that lot size could potentially be. I see Commissioner Kinney has his hand up.
Thank you, Dan. First, hi, everyone. My name is Tim Kinney. I'm the newest commissioner. I'm very happy to be here. Looking forward to working with all of you. I'm an attorney here in Tucson in private practice. I'm also a practitioner of the UDC, so I actually have encountered this problem several times in my career where single family attached is just not allowed anywhere in residential zoning, except for through the FLD process. And the FLD process wasn't really meant for a lot of the types of development that we're seeing. The only other option is to do a condo plat. And while the condo plat is actually relatively easy with the city, it is actually very complicated with the other requirements that the state puts on subdividers of condos. And then also the larger issue with condos is that they are difficult to get financing and mortgages for. So that's why you don't see that many of them in Tucson. So I would say I'm very much in favor of this one. Pretty much any conversion of an office building or a hotel or anything like that, or any lot that has a building covering most of the lot coverage, this makes sense for. Otherwise, the only way to split it up would be to do an FLD, which you probably couldn't do because you need open space, or a condo it, which is very difficult and expensive, and you might not get buyers. So I'm very much in support of this. I think it's a great idea.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Kinney, and welcome. Commissioner Lane, have your hand up.
Hi, thanks, Dan. I'm also in support of this, very much in support of this as somebody who lives in a single family attached dwelling. I love it. So excited about that. But I have a question about why multifamily or places zoned R2 or higher. I get that there's the lot size question, which I think is legitimate. But to me, and maybe I'm misunderstanding ADUs, but it seems a little unfair to, how do I want to put this? ADUs don't have any setback requirements, do they? And they're in single family zoned areas as well. Is that correct?
Commissioner Lane, ADUs do have setback requirements. They're the normal, it's 6 feet, or I think it's 2/3 the height of the building.
Okay. And that's how they're allowed in R1 areas, basically. Yeah. Okay, cool.
That is correct.
Thank you. That was my question.
Of course. Commissioner Zagier, you have your hand up.
I'm also kind of excited to see a development like this. I read through some of the comments. There were pages and pages of comments. And there was one gentleman, I think it was line 72, it was a gentleman from who lives in Menlo Park in a very small house. And he was complaining about, how to expand his house to go up. Can he goes up 2-story? So is there, I'm just throwing this out there. Is there any way if, say, two property owners agree that they actually need to make to expand their lot, can they add like a double wall down their the line of their property line and basically create a semi-attached single family dwellings? You know, you see these a lot back east where, you know, people share one wall, so they're just semi-attached. Is there anything that when this goes through that it would be possible to have a, if, I mean, you would have to have two neighbors agree and actually have the funding to do it. But I'm just throwing that out there as a way for people living in smaller houses to expand maybe sideways rather than going two stories, because sometimes they don't have the support as far as the foundation. Anyway, so I do support this. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Sajir. Yeah, we'd have to take a look. We have some zoning people here. I don't know. Our zoning administrator is here. Lisa, would you, I don't know if you have an understanding of how this could apply potentially to a situation like that. I think that would maybe require a DDO, but it depends on the situation, I suppose.
I don't think I caught the full question. So mind restating it for me? I apologize.
Do you want me to do that? Okay.
I can go ahead. It's fine. I think the idea was that if there's, I guess, two existing property owners next door to each other, and they wanted to kind of both expand, basically to have a shared wall, if they were in the R2 or R3 zone, would this apply to that? Could it potentially become a single family attached, I guess?
I have that in practice, in real life. There are situations where people will reduce their setbacks down. Typically, it's not really less than 3 feet in most instances, because the building code requires a fire rated wall when you get below 3 feet. And so, and then that reduction in getting down to even 3 feet require a DDO or a variance. To get down below 1 foot in your setback, you would have to go through a variance process. And so I think if we were having two neighbors that were getting all the way to the point where their walls were touching each other, they would both have to go through a variance process, which I think would address any of the concerns that maybe would come up. But in that situation, I still would find it unlikely to classify them as a single family attached. I think we would tend to use that description when there's a unified development happening of multiple units being developed simultaneously versus something that's maybe happened over time or comes about of, you know, other kinds of modifications like a variance.
Great. Thank you, Lisa. I appreciate that. Okay, I'm gonna move on to the next one. Next one we have, again, within the remove barriers to small scale infill. This one's related to reducing parking requirements for small multifamily residential. So as it is right now, commercial parking standards are triggered on sites with three or more residences, requiring more space to be dedicated to landscaping. There are stricter surface requirements, so more paving, access, and maneuvering requirements, making it very challenging to fit small multifamily, especially on infill sites. The proposal that is in front of you is to reduce some of those standards to allow for some of those smaller multifamily to fit on some infill sites. So this is proposing to require one parking space per unit for sites with 2 to 5 units. It would allow for more flexibility in the commercial parking standards, so potentially some reductions in PAL width. So the PDMR allowance would go to 20% instead of 10% with approval from Tucson Fire. there would be the allowance with the approval of Department of Transportation and Mobility to potentially utilize alley for some of the access instead of having to have primary access in and out from the major street. And then alternative surface requirements instead of always requiring paving, potentially using other surfaces that that would hold up over time, but may not have stormwater runoff, may not have the urban heat island effect that you would get from just paving over everything. The idea here really is that by lowering the number of sites that trigger commercial parking standards, you would help to encourage small scale infill. It allows for more efficient use of those spaces and reduces impervious surfaces on sites. So we have heard some concern related to this one through our public meetings. And those concerns really are about parking impacts on neighborhoods, including negative effects on walkability, aesthetics, should there be overflow parking from some of these sites that may not be providing as much as is currently required. So just kind of related to that, the reason why this is being proposed is that we really, it helps to achieve climate goals of the city. So they're by reducing paving and always speccing more parking than may be needed, we help to reduce urban heat island effect, stormwater runoff from all that additional pavement. It does help to support transit by supporting infill and helping to kind of increase and maybe potentially get a unit or two more than you would normally, and helping with housing supply issues. It does help to reduce the cost of development and again, address those housing supply issues. It could potentially help to increase some density and more efficiently use existing infrastructure, which is one of the benefits of density. And then, you know, just in a lot of cases, there is existing on-street parking that could potentially be utilized. These are paved areas that are otherwise unused. And it also, a lot of times, having on-street parking does help to reduce traffic speeds in neighborhoods as a traffic calming device. So that's kind of part of the reason why this is what is being presented to you. I see Vice Chair Wellett, you have your hand up.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Just a couple questions. How did we land? Talk to me about how we landed on one parking space per you know, dwelling, if you will, versus some other things there.
Yeah, so Commissioner Wellett, that's a good question. So ultimately, one parking space per unit was proposed because their commercial parking standards, if you go over four spaces, I believe, to five spaces, it automatically kicks in additional commercial parking standards. So the idea here is that by allowing one space per unit, it would not end up kicking into those additional commercial parking standards for those small multifamily units. And that's the reason why we ended up on that one.
Perfect. And I'm assuming an IPP is something that can be utilized, but it being a barrier to the infill development is what we're getting at here a little bit.
Yeah, so it is true. You could potentially utilize the individual parking plan for this. That is, again, it's a full other process that would require notification. A lot of times they take quite a bit of time to do so and money. And you would have to hire an additional consultant to do that a lot of times.
Perfect. So this is more or less for the smaller guys or so trying to make some infill development. Perfect. Well, I noticed that Chuck, in his comments, Commissioner Martin had some concerns associated with that and was suggesting perhaps looking at it more as a multifamily dwelling and, you know, putting in some of those parking requirements. And I don't know if I have an opinion on that matter or not. But I do like the idea of allowing for more flexibility, and I hope that as a city we're considering some other avenues to allow for additional reductions, by right reductions, if you will, in parking, so that we can make more meaningful infill developments. And one thing that, you know, other jurisdictions do, like the town of Marana, for instance, they kind of let the parking demands of the use drive what that parking requirement is, and require that it's based on a what they call a parking justification analysis, if you will. But that adds additional costs. You know, you have to try bring on a traffic engineer. So I understand, you know, what we're trying to do is make it more affordable and cheaper for these smaller scale projects to go through without imposing some additional costs and requirements on them. But just wondering if there's a way to, as we move through this process and further down the road, that we can start to look at analyzing, you know, parking based on demand of the use and what the use typically allows for, if you will, or needs, demands, rather than just basing it on parking or traffic calculations, if you will. So thank you.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Mullet. Commissioner Sagir, you have your hand up.
Yeah. So units, as far as a definition, so 2 to 5 units. So each unit can be what? A studio, a 4-bedroom, what? So I'm curious, you're talking about 2-bedroom units. When a unit of housing can be almost anything. And are these units attached? Is this like an apartment dwelling, or does just one person own, you know, put a FLD in and go, oh, well, I don't have to provide parking. I'll put in this little FLD unit that, you know, on an acre or a half an acre that has 5 units on it, but you only have to provide one parking space for, you know, a family of 4. Is there any way to define it's a multifamily residential area as far as how big can one unit be? Because if you have a family of 4 and a couple of teenagers, you're going to have more than one car. You could have 2 or 3.
And yeah, Go ahead. Yeah. So ultimately, it could be an attached unit, like a multifamily unit that you normally see with like 3 units or 4 basically separate units. You could also have something like, you know, if you've seen the little, the bungalow courts, you could have something that could be potentially multifamily, but detached, like that as well. So that would also be multifamily. Generally, the idea is that there's single ownership and then there's units within, multiple units. So if you go over 5 bedrooms, you have to provide extra parking, and that's kind of like what we've already had for this. But I will say that what we've done in other portions of the code, I mean, should there be direction from the Planning Commission to look at this, you could potentially have a different parking requirement for something that's 1, 2, or 3 bedrooms versus something that's maybe 4 or 5 bedrooms. And that is a possibility as well, to where you could potentially break it down that way if you wanted to address it. And you were worried about a 4-bedroom or a 5-bedroom unit potentially just having 1 parking space. Just related to your question, your comments about the family of 4 with 3 teenagers. Yes, it's very true. There's also family of 4 with 3 kids that may be in grade school that probably would only really need 1 car. So what this does is really provide that flexibility for the user and for whoever is building it for certain people and things of that sort, to where they don't necessarily always need the maximum amount of parking.
So on that, then you would assume that there's a possibility for them, for folks to be able to use a good public transportation system that Tucson really doesn't have right now. It's just thinking of the future, because going to the Plan Tucson meeting, you know, you think you can't think within just one little box. So to get people out of their cars, you've got to be able to take a bus. And if you're only going 3 miles to the store, it shouldn't take you an hour and a half to get there. So sometimes the only choice you have, especially in Tucson, is a car. or sometimes two cars, especially if you have a mom and a dad. The dad takes one car to work and the mom needs the other one to cart the kids around and go to the grocery store. So you're going to have two cars. Even if the kids aren't driving, you're going to end up with probably two cars. So anyway, well, thank you. Just something to think about. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Sajir. Appreciate it. Okay. All right. I'm going to move on to the next one here. This one's related to removing barriers to small-scale infill as well. This is allowing accessory structures in the front yards for shades and carports. So as it is right now, front yard or street yard shade is restricted to structures that are attached to the main building or limited through a variance procedure. What we are proposing is to allow shade structures that are detached and have certain size requirements for shade and carports in the front yards. What this does is it allows more flexibility in adding climate appropriate shade protection for people and property. What we've noticed is there have been a lot of variances that people apply for to put a shade structure in their front yard so they can just provide shade for their car or for even just, sitting areas and things of that sort outside. And most of those get approved and they go through that and then they go through the process. In our review, we've looked at this. What ends up happening is either they go through the variance process or they just end up putting up a structure without going through the whole building review and zoning review process to where they are basically illegal structures. What we're hoping to do here is to encourage people to go through and get these permitted. By permitting them, they end up with better materials. They end up being safe so they can handle wind loads and things of that sort. And they're structurally sound. We presented this at a public meeting a week or two ago. And there were some concerns about the concerns that were really expressed were related to historic properties. And what we reached out to our historic preservation officer just to get her opinion on how this may affect, either HPZs and MPZs, historic preservation zones or neighborhood preservation zones, but also the National Register Historic Districts. They would still have to go through review for the historic preservation zone and the neighborhood preservation zone. But additionally, she's like, unless it's an opaque structure right in the middle, it really shouldn't have that much of an impact. She said really the major issue with delisting would be as if it's actually attached to the structure and not detached. So it's actually modifying that front portion of the house. So what this actually does inadvertently is probably protect those neighborhoods more than the current requirement, which is to attach it to the existing structure. So by allowing for a detached structure, it actually helps with potentially keeping a structure from being delisted. So that is that proposal. I see Commissioner Kinney, you have your hand up.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Real quick, I see that we are proposing to limit these in size to 400 square feet. I'm curious where that number comes from.
Yeah, thanks, Commissioner Kinney. So we were basically thinking two car spaces, generally 20 by 10 or so to allow for that size of an area. That's where that came from.
Okay. Makes sense. Last question, and I'm not sure I'm in support of this, just asking the question. I believe ADUs are now allowed in the front, detached ADUs. Now we're going to possibly allow carports and shade structures. Have we considered allowing detached garages?
We have not discussed this. I think that would have a larger impact than probably the shade structures in the carports. Accessory dwelling units, I believe, and I'm trying to remember back to a year ago, I believe they're only allowed if they're attached to the structure. And if they're detached, they could be either on the side or they could be in the rear for that.
Okay.
You are remembering correct.
Yes. ADUs, to clarify, Commissioner Kinney, are not permitted in the front yard unless they are attached to the home, in which case they would need to meet our standard setback. So it would really only be possible on a lot where the primary home was set back very far on the lot and had space for an ADU in the front to be attached.
Thank you. Okay. We have one more here. All right. And the final one is just related to simplifying development standards. This is standardizing building setbacks on major streets. This does apply a little bit to some kind of clarification for local streets for residential, and I'll go into that a little bit, but it really the impact of, and the major impact related to this one is on major streets. So the issue right now is that building setbacks along major streets are varied because they're based on building height. So they have variable setbacks. This picture down here kind of shows that, to where the higher you go, the more you have to set it back. So it leads to a situation to where building frontage is kind of jump as you go along major streets, not leading to a good urban environment, a good kind of design, kind of standard related, good urban design related to that. It also limits developable area on a site, and then again leads to unpredictable and poor walking environments. So what it ends up doing by having these, it pushes that building back, and in a lot of cases you end up with a sea of parking that is in front of those buildings. It's the existing condition that you see in almost all of Tucson, to where it's a shopping center. There's a sea of parking, and that sea of parking runs right along the sidewalk. So you're out there and you're getting baked by walking next to this sea of asphalt. So what we're looking at here is to establish a standardized front setback dimension along streets that are based on residential and non-residential development instead of building height. And what it is basically a 10-foot setback for commercial commercial buildings. And then as it is right now, it's a 21-foot setback for residential. We would be standardizing that to 20, which is pretty similar to what you see in all of the existing neighborhoods in the city of Tucson related to that. We do feel that this encourages a more predictable and improved built environment along sidewalks and allows for better utilized sites. You'll see there are some developments out there that we'll see to where I think there was a multifamily development that came in recently it ended up having to push itself back because it needed 3 or 4 stories. And again, there's instead of bringing it up to the road and providing that more pedestrian kind of refuge, it ends up with that sea of parking right all around the building. So there has been a suggestion for setbacks for taller buildings, essentially kind of like we have in our infill incentive district. So we have looked at this, and ultimately, and I have a map of kind of some of these areas, but there are very few areas along major corridors that allow for buildings taller than 40 feet. And then also, you know, if you look at the infill incentive district, there are much taller buildings generally downtown than there are in other areas, at least what is allowed by zoning there. And then on top of that, generally, you know, setbacks are usually used on roads with narrow roads away. So if you think about Fourth Avenue, you think about the areas downtown within the infill incentive district, a lot of times, you know, you do that in order to, because of the narrow right of way, generally wider right of ways like Tucson's major roads. I think the rule of thumb is like half the right of way is a good height for a building that's right up on the street. Those are generally don't get stepped back, in the same way that, you would on a more narrow street. So I'm just gonna, kind of give you an example of the kind of difference in development between what we currently have, and then potentially kind of what this would do as far as bringing that building forward. So these are two different Safeways. One is in Tucson, one is not. But again, by having this variable setback, it makes it push it back and it comes back a ways. And then you have your sidewalk here and then and the sea of asphalt. What this would allow would be that 10-foot setback. So the building comes up to the front and then you have the sidewalk that runs right next to it. A kind of interesting example of this that I noticed today while I was walking is actually downtown Links
where it comes by on stone and it comes through. And it actually, the feel of it, as it's gotten closer to those buildings there where the mural is and 7th Avenue Commons, feels a lot better now than it did previously, where there was this big kind of gravel kind of lot that was there, that went there. It's just kind of a different feel when you have a building next to you versus when you have a parking lot. And this real quickly, and then yes, Commissioner Wellett, I will get to your question in a second. We did an analysis of different zones. And what we have here are basically the maximum heights of some of those zones, looking at those that are 40 feet or less, which is basically about three stories, those that are between 40 feet and 75 feet, and then those that are greater than 75 feet. And most of the ones that are greater than 75 feet are either industrial zones down in the southeastern portion of the city. So those would be I-2 zones, industrial zones, or they're in downtown. There are a couple other areas that have OCR1 or OCR2, which are over 75 feet. They're generally, I think, 130 feet or close to 300 feet. One of those is Tucson Medical Center up here, as well as the 54 Broadway. As most people know, that is one of those ones that is one of the higher ones. And then the development, actually, interestingly enough, the development at the corner of Wetmore and Oracle, which is one of the few developments that actually brings that building out to the street a little bit over there. That's kind of similar to that Safeway development. All of this yellow or orange are the ones that are 40 feet to 75 feet. Most of those are really along interstates. And again, this is mostly industrial land. So Davis-Monthan is all zoned I-1. All of this area that's along aviation or downtown, and then again, all the way up Interstate 10 and then down on I-19 here. Then again, down by the airport. So this kind of shows the extent of most of the zoning in the city of Tucson outside of downtown is either industrial or is usually 40 feet or less. So it doesn't, the applicability of this is pretty minor for the most part. And then Commissioner Martin did, in his comments, had a comment related to the use of the FLD and the setbacks for the FLD. So they were using the average daily travel. We were trying to kind of simplify by going from established area and developing area and getting rid of setbacks based on average daily travel, because it's very difficult to gauge. It's difficult for applicants, it's difficult for staff, but there is use of the setbacks for some of the newer developments, not necessarily established developments. So we have some proposed language which related to this. Staff, we met and talked through this and talking about a unified subdivision allowing for front street perimeter to be 5 feet. And that would be the equivalent of what is currently the practice for some of those flexible lot developments that come through. With that, Commissioner Wellett, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
No questions per se, Dan. Just really want to applaud staff for looking at this and really looking and diving into, you know, some of the challenges that have come as a result of the major streets and route setbacks that have been, you know, governing the streets for quite some time, if you will. You know, when I first came to the University of Arizona to get my master's degree, one of the projects that I worked on was, you know, diving into the headaches of the major streets and routes plan. So that was about almost 10 years ago now. So it's one of those, feels like it's come in full circle, and it's really neat to see some practices being put in place that will truly start to make Tucson adapt to an urban form that's conducive to, you know, big city development like we are. So I just want to applaud you and Ms. Hamblin and Nick Ross and everybody in the zoning world over there at the city for diving into this and creating an avenue that is much more conducive to urban development, if you will. So thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Any other comments or questions related to this one? All right. Then just real quickly, some minor code changes that are being proposed. These are kind of some of those cleanup items. And just to give you an example of kind of what we're proposing here. So protective services previously in the land use code was allowed in the RH zone. It's allowed in pretty much every other zone in this in the unified development code, but it was omitted when it was translated. So adding that back in. There is a use table that was omitted for a use specific standard 4971 for home occupation daycare. So fixing that problem. There was one related to domestic violence in table 4.8-5 that references 497J11. There is no use specific standard for 497J11. And then back when we did, and many of you may remember this, we went and did a change to our notification distances that was based on kind of changes at the state level related to rezonings, where we went from 50 feet to 100 feet and then 300 feet to 400 feet, but removed the skipping the right-of-way portion. And there were a couple of those portions that didn't get caught previously, so cleaning up those items. So with that, happy to answer any questions. Staff recommends the Planning Commission to set this Planning and Development Services Code Update Package for a public hearing on February 15th, 2023. Thank you.
Is there a motion?
Chair Castillo, I'll make a motion here. So I'll make the motion that staff recommends I'll make the motion to set the Planning and Development Services Code Update Package for a public hearing on February 15th, 2023.
Thank you. We have a motion from Vice Chair Wellett. Is there a second?
Second.
Second from Commissioner, I believe that was Kinney.
Yep.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? That passes unanimously. Thank you very much to staff for all the hard work on that. Move on to agenda item number 6, which is PDSD staff announcements.
This is Corinne Manning, Planning Administrator. I just want to make one announcement, which we neglected to make earlier, which is to welcome our newest commissioner, Commissioner Tim Kinney. So welcome to the Planning Commission. Mr. Kinney is a land use attorney in Tucson, and we are glad to have him on the commission. Anything you want to say, Tim?
Thank you, Corin. No, I think I kind of covered it earlier, but I'm happy to be here. Looking forward to working with all of you and getting to know all of you as well. So thank you.
Great. Thank you for your time and service to our community in this way. Commissioner
McConsey. I'd just like to make a motion that we have maybe one meeting in early 2023 in person, just so someone like me who's new to all this could get a chance to meet everybody like out there in the real world. Doesn't have to be every time, just one, so we can like kind of get acquainted.
Thank you for that suggestion. We have been discussing in-person versus virtual meetings, hybrid. Many city commissions, boards and commissions are still meeting virtually. However, others are meeting in person. So that is something that Planning Commission could discuss. We have actually seen very strong public participation in the virtual format at public hearings, not just at Planning Commission, but Zoning Examiner and other hearings. So that's something we're kind of weighing. Another option, Commissioner, and something we have floated in the past is perhaps just a social meet and greet, as we do have a number of new commissioners. If that's something Planning Commission would appreciate and where we would get attendance, we would be happy to set something like that up. Many other boards and commissions have held similar activities outside of a formal hearing for folks to get acquainted, and we could do that as well.
Yeah, I think that would be pretty helpful, at least speaking for myself.
Great. Thank you for that. We will work with your new chair and vice chair to schedule something. And I think one of the big updates for Planning and Development Services is our general plan, which you got an overview of earlier, just that we're launching that process. As you know, we have new permitting software EnerGov or Tucson Development Center Online is our new online system for applications. I do want to mention that we have a number of trainings available to the public, including stakeholders, folks who submit applications frequently and work with us frequently are encouraged to attend those training sessions. And I will link to that in the chat in case any of you are interested. We're doing those about once a month for the next several months.
Great, thank you. Any other announcements from staff? Okay, we'll move on to agenda item number 7, future agenda items. Are there any future agenda items anyone would like to propose?
Yes, Chair Cassidy. So in the future, or coming up in the near future, we will have a public hearing on the PDSD code update package. Additionally, we have had some direction from Mayor and Council to look at some water conservation items and amendments, one of which is a ban on non-functional turf, along with some other items related to separate water utility meters for commercial development. And those will be in front of you in the near future.
Great, thank you. And then we'll move on to agenda item number 8, which is the call to the audience. I don't have a script. Do I need to read the script, or can I just announce that the floor is open to members of the public who'd like to speak on an item not on the agenda? Okay, if anybody from the public would like to speak, either raise your hand or go ahead and unmute yourself. I'll give you a little while to speak up. Okay, seeing no hands and hearing no voices, we will move on to agenda item number 9, which is adjournment. We have a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Motion by Vice Chair Wellett. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by, I believe that was Commissioner McKenzie. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay, well, thank you all for your attendance tonight. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night, everyone. Thank you.